Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on, oh, it's a great Monday out there, isn't it? The sun is shining. The birds are singing.
Beautiful.
Maybe not at 39th and Main. But somewhere they are singing as you listen to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. Two shows to tell you about, both musicals, two very different musicals, and we're going to hear about both of the shows and why you might find it interesting. We'll talk to you about all of that along the way. First, we're going to journey on over to, well, to Pin Valley Park, where the Spinning Tree Theater Company will be presenting Ain't Misbehaving, the Fats Waller musical show, beginning on Friday, November 1st, not too long away now, just days away. Preparations are underway. And with us to tell us all about it, the co-directors of the show. Might ask them what it's like to co-direct. They're partners, and they're co-directing this show. Michael Grayman is with us. Andy Parkhurst. Interesting history. They moved here from New York 3 years ago to start this theater. And I guess, Andy, you're from Kansas City?
I am, yes.
Yes. So you went to New York. Did you know Michael before you went to New York?
No, I didn't. We met on a tour of West Side Story and became partners on a tour later of Mamma Mia.
Oh, so that's how you met Michael. So Michael's from Cincinnati, you told me, and then you moved to New York. And
yeah, I moved to New York. I also lived in L.A. for a little while, too, and
was on the road with several shows, too.
Yeah. Well, you got together, but you decided to come back to Kansas City. I'm sure people would like to know, why Kansas City?
Great city for arts and culture, great theater town. I had been back to choreograph a number of professional productions while living in New York, and always just found it a more relaxing place to work on shows. And Michael had journeyed with me here and enjoyed it. We love the people. We love the arts community.
We're more laid back here, aren't
yes,
we?
Yes, indeed. In a good way. It's true.
Michael, have a comment on that? More
no,
laid
it's
back?
True. We are more laid back, but it also is a busy city. There's lots to do here, mm-hmm. too.
So did you consider Cincinnati, your home area?
Did look at Cincinnati. It was in both cases. Kansas City supports the arts a little bit more than Cincinnati does. As far as welcoming smaller theater companies, we here in Kansas City we're a little more open to that. I think Cincinnati haven't supported the small theater companies as much. And again, I think this is just sort of a larger market for it, too.
See, people comment to me all the time, we're surprised there's so much theater here. Right. Not that there isn't. All the cities have their own version of a repertory theater, usually associated with a mm-hmm. university, and maybe a professional dinner theater or two. Kansas City has more than that, but Kansas City, they say, has more of these smaller companies than
it's
a lot
true.
Of other towns.
Yeah, I mean, most towns have a KC rep and then a unicorn. And maybe a Shakespeare festival, which is kind of like what Cincinnati has. But this has a lot more, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you are presenting in what better town than Kansas City to do a Fats Waller music show.
Perfect place for it.
The Ain't Misbehaving, a host of Kansas City favorites in the show here. Mm-hmm. Casting must have been very interesting for you. There's fine singers, and did you have people in mind when you first began?
We did. We have a wonderful group. I mean, we probably could have cast the show three times in town, but we sure are thrilled with the group that we have together. We have Ebony Fondren, Jenny Greenberry, Matthew King, Ron Lackey, and Linnea McKenzie, and they are all wonderful triple threat performers, so they are singing, dancing, and acting for you all over the stage.
All over the stage.
It's a fully staged production with scenery, costumes, choreography, a really good time, and it's been a joy to work with this group.
Ebony was seen locally, I believe, in Little Shop of Horrors.
Right.
That was the one at the Rep?
Correct.
Yeah, Hairspray at the New Theater. Mm-hmm. Ron Lackey was in Bud Not Buddy mm-hmm. at the Coterie Theater. Right. Jenny Greenberry, she was one of them that traveled to New York to do
She did Lucky Duck with Coterie, and she did Shipwrecked for us for Spinning Tree earlier this year.
Yeah. Let's see who else.
Got Linnea.
Linnea McKenzie, Ragtime at the Met. Spring Awakening at the Coterie. Mm-hmm. And Matthew King, Death of Cupid at the Living Room. And Ragtime at the Met.
Fantastic group.
Great group.
Good group. You also have a musical director
we
as
do.
Well.
We do. Angie Benson. Angie Benson. It's our first time to work with Angie, and she is incredible. And she is the musical director and the pianist. And she is joined on stage by Brian Wilson on bass, upright bass, and Julian Goff on percussion. And actually, Angie's husband, Michael Benson, is the scenic designer. And he's in charge of technical theater and scenery at UCM Warrensburg. So it's been a delight to have him and his students come each evening the past week and get the set built.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Brian Wilson on bass. You see him all over town.
Right.
For the most part, you see him at Quality Hill Playhouse.
That's right. That's right.
With Julian.
Julian Goff, who's on the drums this time. They both will often be at Quality Hill Playhouse. Oh, man, Brian's not going to be a single man too much longer. He doesn't mind my saying.
No, I bet he doesn't.
He and Catherine Long, the singer, will be getting married this spring in, I believe she told me, South Carolina.
That's great.
So he'll be taken, ladies.
He's
not too long
great
away.
Guy. Great
he'll
guy.
Be taken. Well, let's talk a little bit about Misbehavin'. Michael told me not much of a storyline to it. It's mostly song driven.
It's a review. It is the only review to ever win the Tony Award for Best Musical. It's from 1978, so that makes it, what, about 35 years old. It still feels like it was written just yesterday. And the songs, many of them are 100 years old or more, but the way that they're arranged, both with the vocals and the instruments, they're so fresh and so contemporary. It's all the music from Fats Waller and the Harlem Renaissance of the 1930s.
Which, of course, was such an exciting time in history. It's when artists like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston, and it was a huge, huge resurgence in Harlem. At the time, people were moving up from the South for freedom. A lot of African Americans were moving up north. Yeah. And it was a really great time in history. And that's true. All the songs do reflect that excitement of that time.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of those songs, since that's basically the show is the music here.
That's right.
No real story-driven. Fats Waller doesn't make a cameo appearance, does
no.
he? No. But that would be interesting, wouldn't
that
it?
That would be interesting.
Or someone as Fats
right,
Waller.
Right,
I always throw in little hints. Yes. You don't have to listen to me at all. At all, Andy. You have to pay attention to me at all. But
sure.
Let's talk about the songs in the show. Now, some of these I'm sure people hear quite often, and some they probably don't hear very much at all.
I mean, of course, the title song, Ain't Misbehavin', is very, very well known. I've Got a Feeling I'm Falling.
Honeysuckle Rose.
Oh.
Black and Blue. Very, very
beautiful
famous
song.
And beautiful song.
That's sort of the emotional heart of the show, Black and Blue. Two sleepy people. I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Ain't nobody's business if I do. That's kind of a well-known one, too. They're all going to be something that people can touch on to and say, wow, I remember that,
right.
Which is really exciting.
Right.
Yeah, were the singers familiar with the songs? Probably not all of them. They're pretty young, some of them.
Without getting too specific, we have a bit of an age range in the cast.
Yes.
And the more junior members of the company were perhaps discovering some new material for them to audition with. And I think Ebony is finding some of the pieces that she'd like to try out in her jazz sets around town. And, you know, some of them were more familiar than others, but they are loving the music. And what was interesting in staging the show is that we'd get to a new number and we'd all go, oh, my God, that's my new favorite song in the show. Each song just works so well. And there's ballads, there's up-tempos, there's songs with dancing in them, songs that are choreographed. There's some torch songs.
Keeping
in it
Out
that
of Mischief
are
Now.
Wonderfully
that's a
dramatic.
Famous one.
Yeah, Keeping Out of Mischief Now. Mean to Me.
Oh,
of course, Nell Carter won the Tony Award for the show, and this is the show that made her a big star.
Yeah. Did she sing the role that Ebony?
Well, we've
is
kind
singing?
Of mixed it up a bit.
Oh, you do? Okay.
It doesn't follow in the program. There's no character names next to the actors. It's just the cast playing different facets and parts of themselves. So we mixed it up with Angie Benson, the musical director, and sat down and said, you know, after hearing each of them and talking to each of them, what would be best for each of them to sing. So it doesn't follow a strict Nell track or Armelia track or Charlene track.
Well, the style, of course, is different than what some of the young ladies, at least, have probably sung before. How difficult was it, or what kind of helping hints did you, or either of you, or Miss Benson, help them to get into the proper style of the show? It's a little different singing songs like this than the regular Broadway show tunes that they're used to singing.
Well, it's interesting because it's a little bit of both. There is a little bit of there's a musical theater sound to it too. But then, you know, for example, with Ebony bringing in her jazz background, she sings Cash for Your Trash, and there's sort of like a scatting section to it. So that was pretty easy for her to do too. So everybody kind of moved into it pretty well. And again, I think it's arranged so that it does have a musical theater sound combined with the jazz swing.
They just fit right in though, and their voices just fit right in like butter to these songs. It wasn't a difficult transition. If anything, we've talked about the honesty that it takes to sing these songs, and that probably in 1978, when the show opened on Broadway and won the Tony Award for Best Musical, there probably was more of what we would call general singing now, which is you're just singing a song and you sound good singing it. In this day and age, it's not enough for the discerning audience, and certainly our patrons are discerning. So we talk about the story involved with each song, and for many of the songs, it's quite personal for the actor. So Michael and I will talk with them one-on-one about who are you singing to? What is the circumstance? What's different at the end of the song than was so at the beginning? And they've really enjoyed that process, and we sort of insist upon that process.
Absolutely.
To make it more interesting for them, which makes it more interesting for the audience.
Well, it certainly makes it more interesting for the audience to learn. So that.
And it's important, like Andrew said, when you're doing a review, especially because obviously when you're doing a musical, it's a little bit easier to go from dialogue into song. And again, when you're singing a bunch of different stories, like you do with review, we did the same thing with Make Me a Song, the music of William Finn, making sure that every actor touched on a personal aspect of themselves for each song.
Yeah. When Fats Waller sang these songs back in his time, did he do that at all? Well, did each song, because songs tell a story.
Right.
Sometimes there's not a lot of a story,
right?
But songs tell a story sometimes, and I'm just interested to know about Waller and why some of the songs, and are there stories behind some of those songs?
There are. I would say, though, and we've looked at a lot of video, you know, archival video footage, and read a lot about him and that time period with music, but a lot of it was that the African-American was there to serve the white audience. So it was entertainment. And if you look at video footage of Fats, he's playing the piano and he's singing. He almost always has a giant smile on his face, no matter what he's singing about.
Huge eyebrows going up and down. You know, he's very, very, very expressive, making funny face, you know, making just, you know, charming, wonderful faces.
Well, that is an interesting point you make. Yeah, he was singing for a white audience, even though his following was both.
Right.
But that's
right.
Probably who he was mostly singing for.
Right, especially in the video segments that were on television.
Yeah. Yeah, we're speaking. Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and then when he wrote Black and Blue, that got more to the point of what, you know, the racism. In this country, and that was a little bit of a changing point for him too, because he decided to obviously write about, you know, what was happening in this country at the time.
Yeah, we're speaking with Andy Parkhurst and Michael Grayman. They're the co-directors and founders, actually, of Spinning Tree Theater Company. Their show, Ain't Misbehavin', the Fats Waller musical show, opens this Friday, November the 1st, at 8:00 p.m. at the Just Off Broadway Theater in Pin Valley Park. Performances continue on Saturday at 8, a matinee on Sunday afternoon at 2:00 p.m. Then two more weekends after that, Thursday, Friday, Saturday evenings, Sunday afternoon, for the next two weekends after this, at the Just Off Broadway Theater, which is in Pin Valley Park, at 3051 Central, Kansas City, Missouri, at the very south end of Pin Valley Park. When you're in the parking lot of the Just Off Broadway Theater, you see 31st Street.
That's right.
That's how far south you are. And it is difficult to get into.
If you're going down either Main or Broadway, you want to turn onto Linwood. And then from Linwood, turn north onto Wyandotte. Wyandotte is the street that takes you to the theater, and it's just north of that interstate there.
Yeah, exactly. There's a nice overpass that you go under, and the theater's right there.
Yeah, you often will see people. This is a warning to you out there. You often will see people going out the, going in the exit
right.
ramp.
Exactly.
And you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's so it's hard to get in there from that direction. So you have to go south of 31st, then come around.
It's better to. We're advising patrons to do so. It's just clear.
Yeah, that's a nice little facility. You were in different places before that, but
we
you're now in the JOB.
We use a variety of venues around town. We use off-center theater often, but we have this is our fourth venue and our seventh production, and we really enjoy getting out in the community and collaborating with other organizations as well as using other venues.
Now, in your, is it 3 years now?
We're starting our third season.
You're starting your third season,
that's
so
right.
Two full years, beginning your third.
Right.
You seem to do, we did a variety of things, but you like to do musicals. That's obvious because you...
It's been about half and half. Huh? This season we have two musicals and a play. But we make sure that the musicals mean something, and mean something to us. We try to pick musicals that have good books, you know, substantial books that tell a story and are interesting. We like the reviews, too, and we like to, you know, like we've been talking about a bit, bringing more to the songs, bringing more acting to the reviews, so it's not just your typical go and hear pretty singing, which is also nice, but you're getting more. You're going to feel like it's a book show, even though most of the dialogue is ad-lib. From the actors.
Yeah. And Kansas City premieres are also important to us, too, when it comes to musicals. We just did Hello Again in this past May, and it's by five-time Tony Award nominee Michael John Lacusa, who's one of our honorary advisors. And it was a musical that we were both very, very interested in. So we actually flew him here to Kansas City, and he was actually able to come to a show and then conduct a talk back afterwards. So it's also important to reach out to our honorary advisors and to work in that capacity, but also introduce the city to great musicals.
Now, did you pick that show because of Kansas City, in part because of Kansas City and its heritage, musical heritage?
The Amos Behaven show?
This particular one I was thinking
of. Yeah, I mean, it's just always been on our list. You know, I had, when I was a little boy, I had the dual cassette recording of the original Broadway cast of Amos Behaven, and I wore it out.
Oh, really?
And memorized every word of it. And my grandparents had tickets to Starlight Theater. Of course, they were season ticket subscribers. They had box seats. And this is when all the women wore dresses and the men wore suits and ties.
Oh, I remember.
To Starlight. And,
I'm older than you.
Yeah.
I remember.
Well, they gave me their third ticket to go see Amos Behaven when the tour went out with Nell Carter and the original cast. And I was thrilled. And Bob Roth, who was running the theater at the time, made a curtain speech, and he said, "I'm sorry to let you know that due to illness, Nell Carter will not be performing."
Oh.
And I remember the feeling. I was probably nine, and I was devastated. And how could that be? And I've come all the way here, and I've listened to her voice. Well, I still loved the show, of course. And at that young age, that has ever since been one of my favorite musicals, and is one of the recordings that I can listen to endlessly. And never get tired of it, and not skip tracks.
Yeah, well, in a way of combining things, then the person that stood in for her that night, as well as the performers in your show, how much do you want them to vary from the traditional way of doing it? There's, you know, singers like to try things out in their own way. Whoever subbed for Miss Carter on that night, they probably didn't do it exactly like Nell Carter.
We always encourage our performers to do their own thing. Mm-hmm. We never, ever want anybody to replicate. Absolutely. And it's actually interesting you brought that up, because it's possible that the understudy for Nell Carter was told to kind of do a Nell Carter impersonation.
That used to be the way.
Yeah,
really.
Which is interesting. I think when we had talked about this, too, when Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick were replaced with the producers, they were kind of replaced with people that did impressions of that, like
right.
Complete impressions of what they did. So I, you know, sometimes they do that with us. No, absolutely, bring your own. It's almost a more youthful cast too. So we're just like, bring it.
Yeah, we cast them because of their gifts and their talents and the way they do things, the way they interpret and sing a song. So we want them to fully bring that, as opposed to copying anyone.
Sure. Well, let's pick on.
Yeah.
let's pick out Jenny, for
sure.
Instance. Did you have certain songs in mind for her?
Absolutely.
Did you work it that way as you auditioned people?
Jenny is the only one of this cast that we had worked with before on a Spinning Tree production. So we knew Jenny as an actor from Shipwrecked, an excellent actor. And right away, you know, Michael had in mind a couple of songs that he wanted for Jenny to take.
Yeah, there's with her, in a sense, with these two songs, we're having her sing, you know, two ballads, Squeeze Me, and then in the second act, Mean to Me.
Oh.
and Squeeze Me is kind of flirty at the beginning of a relationship, and Mean to Me is at a time where there's conflict. So we did actually talk with Jenny about, you know, having that in mind, a beginning and end, which is a journey for her. And again, I think originally those two songs are sung by two different people. And so we did try and play with something there with that for Jenny.
You should have the right, legal-wise, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you should have the right, I think, to change things around like that. You're not required by contract to have one singer do certain songs.
Not on this show.
They don't care?
Typically, you would be. Typically, yeah. In a normal contract where there are characters, you would not want to do that without seeking and getting permission. But on this show, we had free reign.
Was it difficult to get the rights to this show? I would have thought it would be.
It wasn't. I mean, not that we know of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that probably the Richard Maltby Jr., who co-conceived it and directed the original, I would imagine it has to go through his people.
Yeah.
Usually when there's a living writer involved, it has to go through their agent or lawyer team. But with this show, it wasn't difficult. And actually, it seems like it's not being done a lot for whatever reason. We are just thrilled to be doing it. We, you know, had imagined we would do it at some point, and it's great to be doing it this early in the Spinning Tree Theater life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's originally was, I guess, set in Harlem.
Yeah.
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 A cotton club-esque location. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and we talked about that, of kind of not making it a museum piece, so not doing the scenery exactly like it was, but also not making it set here and now. So it's sort of a mix of old and new, and we've been discovering that with how we sing the songs too. How much riffing do we do? We don't want it to sound like today, the, you know, kind of American Idol riffing, but we also can take some liberties with the way that we interpret the song vocally. So in terms of scenery, costumes, the movement, we're not trapped in a time period, but we reflect parts of that time period.
Yeah, no, I hope I'm right about this. I was scanning the notes as you were speaking. These are all songs that Waller wrote as well as
no,
before.
No, they're not.
No? Okay.
And that's an important distinction. Some of them he wrote, he performed all of them. Many of them he made famous.
But like Two Sleepy People, I'm Going to Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter, those are songs that he made famous, for example. And what's kind of nice is the finale of the show is a chunk of songs that he recorded but didn't write.
So, you know, I'm going to assume that he probably performed a lot at the Cotton Club in Harlem.
He did.
Oh, yeah.
He did.
With his group, Fats Waller and His Rhythm.
Yeah.
And band. So, yeah.
And the story goes that actually he had died on a train between Los Angeles and New York, and that the train passed through Union Station, Kansas City, with his body on it. And further alleged mythology states that on another train heading from east to west was Louis Armstrong.
Oh, really?
And the trains passed. I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes for a nice little story.
It's a nice little story. It's true, yeah.
Well, that is an interesting success. So somewhere in Kansas.
It is. Some people have told us they remember that having happened. I know when we did masterclass last fall about Maria Callas, costume designer Mary Traylor said, oh, you know, she stayed in Kansas City. After her breakup, she came to Kansas City and lived with a gentleman who passed away recently, but to get away from the paparazzi, to get away from it all. She had a very good friend here who was very well-to-do, and she lived with him for quite some time.
So
you hear these stories about Kansas City, you know, 7 degrees of Kansas City.
All
shows
the
we
time.
Do. Well, it was kind of, it was the center of the country.
That's right.
And Union
That's
Station
right.
was the
was
center track, as well as Municipal Airport.
That's
later
right.
on, the late Walt Bodine told me some stories one time of he covered the beat of Municipal Airport, and it was a stopping point between New York and Los Angeles. The plane stopped and refueled, and stars would often eat in that little cafeteria.
Really?
And he told me some stories about that, which we don't have time for. Perhaps another time. But opening this Friday night, the Spinning Tree production of Ain't Misbehaving, the Fats Waller musical show. It runs the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd this first weekend. So just remember, an evening performances on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, although this week it's Friday and Saturday, then a Sunday afternoon matinee. The next week, Thursday, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon. And then the third week, beginning the 14th, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon matinee at the Just Off Broadway Theater, the actual address, 3051 Central, Kansas City, Missouri. If you MapQuest things, I don't know that all the changes in road work would be on the MapQuest by now, but if you MapQuest things, the zip code you need to fill in, 64108. It's at the south end of Pin Valley Park. The number to call for more information, stop me if I'm giving the wrong one, 816-569-5277, or online at your website as well, spinningtreetheater.com.
Correct.
And either one of those locations to see Ain't Misbehaving.
And detailed directions are also on our website.
Yeah. Well, let's see. What do we have? We have like a minute and a half. So what other things planned for the rest of the year, just briefly?
Oh, yeah. We are starting our third season. We have three shows. We are doing next Motherhood Out Loud, which is a hit off-Broadway play that was last year in New York City. So another Kansas City premiere. Great cast. Natalie Licardello, Kelly Maine, Julie Shaw, and Rick Truman.
Julie Shaw gets around, doesn't
she? She does. She's been good to us. We love that Julie Shaw. And then we close our season in May with A Little Night Music.
Oh.
Stephen Sondheim's Send in the Clowns musical.
Yeah.
And that's also a wonderful cast. Melinda McDonald, Charles Fugate, Molly Denninghoff,
Lauren Brayton, Victor Zofoniason from our production of The Fantastics,
Liz Clark Golson.
And many others.
And many others.
Yeah. On the web at spinningtreetheater.com. And is this number yours or the JOB's? The
That's 569,
ours. 816-569-5277. I want to thank my guests for being with us to tell us about Fats.
Yes.
Fats Waller, the Fats Waller musical Ain't Misbehaving, opening this Friday night, November 1st, at the Just Off Broadway Theater and continuing for the next three weekends.
It'll be a great
at
night.
At the Just Off Broadway Theater. Thank you both for being with us. Andy Parkhurst, co-director, Michael Grayman, co-director. Didn't get into the mostly when they disagree on things.
It probably happens sometimes.
Every now and
we'll
then.
Be back.
Every day. Thanks so much for
Thanks,
being
Michael.
Here. We're going to take our break. When we return, another musical to talk about, another famous musical at a different place. And this is before we get into all those holiday shows, which we're going to be getting into soon, believe it or not. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM.
Freeze Frame!
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. The combination of Oscar-winning director Tony Scott, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Cormac McCarthy, and a first-rate cast should have resulted in a riveting drama. Unfortunately, The Counselor is an utter miscalculation. Dark, ugly, and off-putting, this thriller about the fruits of greed may be too smart for its own good. Michael Fassbender plays the title character, a lawyer who opts to take part in a drug trafficking deal. That decision winds up having negative effects he never could have imagined. McCarthy's rhetorical dialogue would have worked better in a novel, but sounds downright silly coming out of the mouths of the characters. Fassbender is excellent, and the cast members do the best they can with the thorny script, but the end result is that The Counselor is a convoluted and ultimately dreary drama with an utterly bleak worldview. On the other end of the intellectual spectrum comes Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa. Johnny Knoxville dons elaborate old-age makeup to play an 86-year-old man who goes on a cross-country journey with his 8-year-old grandson, played by Jackson Nickel. Along the way, they prank unsuspecting people with their inappropriate R-rated behavior, and the video is captured Borat-style. This movie is wrong in every conceivable way, but thanks to the genuine reactions of the people who get punked, it's often very funny. Anyone easily offended should stay far, far away. Also opening this week, A Touch of Sin is a Chinese drama reportedly inspired by four actual events that examine the effects of greed on contemporary Chinese society. The Summit is a drama about the ill-fated 2008 attempt by 22 climbers to scale K2. The Glenwood Arts will feature a couple of winners from the Kansas International Film Festival, the documentary Blood Brother, and Construction, a comedy about blue-collar workers looking for love. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM.
Freeze Frame!
Welcome to This Week on Stage, underwritten by KC Stage Magazine, your most comprehensive source for performing arts in Kansas City. Find out what's playing at kcstage.com. Opening this week, Forever Plaid, Chestnut Fine Arts Theater, The Mousetrap, City Theater of Independence, Ain't Misbehavin', the Fats Waller Musical Show, Spinning Tree Theater, This week only, Pat Hazel's The Wonder Bread Years, Carlson Center of JCCC, Beauty and the Beast, Belton High School Theater, Alice in Wonderland Jr., Ferris Youth Theater Company. Still playing this week, Your Hit Parade, Quality Hill Playhouse, Seminar, Unicorn Theater, All My Sons, River City Community Players, Musical Mondays 2013, Musical Theater Heritage, The Parlor Series 2013, Musical Theater Heritage. Closing this week, The Fox on the Fairway, New Theater Restaurant, A Piece of My Heart, Olathe Civic Theater Association, Carrie the Musical, EGAD's Theater Company. These shows can be reviewed online on our website at kcstage.com. Over 200 performing arts organizations listing auditions, performances, and events. Week on Stage is a public service of KC Stage Magazine and 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Who's gonna drive you
home tonight? Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-2277.
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station. Right here in Kansas City, I'm Michael Hoag, your host. We're going to journey on a little further south. We're going to go over to the Johnson County side. We're in our minds. We're going to journey a little further south down to the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City, where at the White Theater, opening on Saturday, November the 9th, Les Miserables. You got to get the last B in there.
That's right.
That's the story of my own interpretation here. From the first time I saw it at Starlight Theater, I always considered it the story of a man on the run, kind of a misconceived. We'll let the actor describe the character as he sees it later on.
Yeah, I read the book too.
I thought of it as kind of maybe the TV series The Fugitive and the movie with Harrison Ford was kind of perhaps loosely based on this. And when I saw that the policeman chasing him was not kind of Jordan in the show, so I thought somebody did get a little.
Yeah,
bit
well, there. I like to think that I am exactly like Harrison Ford,
but not David. That's the voice of Robert Hingula. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, sir.
You play that man on the run. I'm going to let you say the character's name. I don't want to botch it up.
I know. Jean Valjean.
Jean Valjean. Right. We also have Julie Call.
Yes.
And you play the role of... Oh, pull the mic closer. Everyone wants to hear your lovely voice.
Fantine.
And also the director... Barb Nichols is with us as well. She's directed before at the Barn Players, probably other places than that as well. But they've moved you down to the White Theater now.
It's my first show at the White Theater.
Yeah, challenges is there. It's a bigger space.
It's a bigger space, a bigger house, a lovely facility. Yeah. So it's been very good so far.
Yeah, so far so good. Great music, great performers. But a challenging show to do, I would assume. It's all music. There's very little dialogue, if any at all.
Absolutely. And honestly, it's it's funny when you do a show like Les Mis that so many people have listened to for years, and you think you really have a handle on this music, and then you go in and realize, you know what? No actor has ever sang this the way it's written. And
and probably that continues with you.
I will admit, probably, exactly. There's a couple spots you're like, oh, look, and then, oh, wow, no recording ever has this little portion of music. So, that's always a challenge, but it is fun. It's a fun challenge. It's kind of like doing Sondheim for the first time. You know what I mean? It's something as an actor you can really sink your teeth in, something that at the end you feel really accomplished, to hopefully that people enjoy it and that you've done it well, given the piece, the justice.
Now, what's your take on this, Julie?
I would absolutely agree with Robert. I think one of the... Moving closer to the mic.
Yeah.
An incredibly emotional show, very taxing, I think, for all of the actors, because it is a lot of singing, especially, someone like Robert, who's on stage the entire time. I mean, my character is only on for a portion of the show, but it's at a very emotional portion of the show. So it is, definitely, it's a thrill to get to play this role. I mean, it's one that I've seen for years and have loved, you know, every minute of that, but it is also, you know, emotionally exhausting. I mean, it's definitely a great challenge to get to play that kind of a character as well.
Yeah, the challenge that everything is, for the most part, everything is sung. So
yes,
you not only have to tell the story through song and you're performing as well. So, you know, some of the best acting I see is in an opera, for instance, where they're acting and singing at the same time. Not much difference in this show here.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, the way the music is written brilliantly, and that's why I've always preferred musicals, is because music helps amplify that emotion. And Les Mis is written extremely well, I think, in that. And I mean, it's written like an opera, that, you know, you got a lot of recitatives in there, which I despise now. But no, those are the trickiest parts for me to learn, at least. But you know, you have a lot of those opera elements into it, and it's really I consider it to be very much like an opera, is that the music really helps portray those emotions.
Yeah, and you're also telling a story. There is very much definitely a story to this to follow. Who would like to tackle that? Would the director like to tackle that? Do you want Robert to tackle it? What about Julie?
Well,
Julie's looking away like, don't pick on me.
I think what you said, it's about a man who is accused of a crime and imprisoned and finally gets free, but cannot really pursue the life he wants unless he breaks his parole.
Uh-huh.
And so he has to do that to move forward, but the policeman is always on his trail. And there's a lot more to that. It's a book that's probably 1,300 pages long that we tell in 3 hours. So you deal with revolution, pre-revolution France, and the student uprising, and the poor, and the wealthy, and all aspects of life, from con artists to mayors to rich people to poor people. And people who've talked to me, they say, you know, I love the show because it's so uplifting. And then I'll talk to other people say, I'm not going to come see it because it's so sad. And, you know, it's all of those things.
Uh-huh.
And it's life. It's the good and the bad and the joy and the sorrow, and it's all sung beautifully and told on the stage.
And corruption is kind of universal.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't expect you to comment on that. I'll let my own words stand alone there. But that does play a part in why he has to be on the run the way he is.
It is. I mean, you know, and I think that's why the part, I really love the part of Valjean, I mean, especially at the beginning. And, you know, they, as Barb kind of alluded to, I read the book as kind of research to see. And it's interesting that, you know, you learn characters. The first 200 pages of the book are about the priest, the bishop, you know, and you learn all these little things. But what I love about the story with Valjean particularly is you have a guy who was imprisoned for 19 years for such a small crime and had never had mercy bestowed on him at all.
He stole a loaf of bread?
Exactly,
something like that.
Yeah.
And that's,
you know,
all there was,
yeah,
to it. Yeah.
Stole, and, you know, he tried to escape several times, you know, and those type of things as well. But, you know, again, never had shown mercy or compassion shown upon him. And then this bishop shows one act of kindness to him. And something like that is just, remember, even for today's sake, is such a big theme about how that can change someone's life. You know, with Valjean being brought in, and I think most people are familiar with the beginning of the show where the bishop brings him in, gives him a meal, and then Valjean even steals from him, and the bishop still even forgives him. And not only that, even lies for him to cover up and says, now you go forward and you change your life. And that's such a catalyst to go and change Valjean's life. And he goes through and lives the rest of his life always thinking about other people, always thinking about what I can do. You know, I think that's the thing between him and Fantine. What hurts him so much is because I had an opportunity to help somebody else like somebody helped me, and I wasn't aware to it. I wasn't attuned to it. I didn't see it. And I think that's, you know, that's why the Fantine Valjean portion of the story is so important, and why he goes, gets Cosette and all these other things, and he lives these duties through his life because of that. And I think it's just a good message today that, you know, we can always help other people out, and you never know how much little random acts of kindness will help others.
So you don't know their whole story, so you don't know how that's going to fit in.
Exactly.
When it fits in. How about the way, Julie, your character fits into the story? Elaborate on what
Robert said. Well, Fantine is definitely I guess you could say, fallen on hard times. She had a child, obviously, who the man she had the child with left them pretty early on, and then she had to send the child to live with what turns out to be a pretty awful couple. Pretty sure I would like to think that she didn't know how awful they were when she sent the child to live with them, but is trying to make money at a factory and basically is pretty much abused there. The other girls don't like her, think she's kind of uppity to the rest of them, and then she ends up getting fired because of the other girls in the factory, so loses her job, falls on hard times, ends up in a house of ill repute, I guess you could say, and then is beaten there, ends up basically dying because of what has happened to her and what she's experienced, and really is Valjean, who she experienced in the factory, who ignored her, basically turned away when she was trying to get help from him, then finds her again and recognizes her, and she, you know, they, in their conversation to each other, you know, I know that you saw me and you turned away, and so this time he helps her and promises to take care of her child after she dies, and so that kind of carries through to the rest of the show, and then she comes full circle at the end with Fantine as a ghost when Valjean's life is ending and she's really, you know, taking away his burdens there again. So I love that part of the story between the two of them, that it gets to come back as well at the end.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask the director, how do you tie all this together? Well, let's put it this way. Do you not mind if they've read the book or seen other performances of the show? Would you rather mold them in that way? Or would you rather that they completely divorce themselves, so to say, at least for a while? Because some directors will say, no, I know it's a movie. When I did The Mousetrap years ago, the director told us at the time, don't want you to watch any TV shows and no movie versions. And of course, don't check the script out of the library. I don't want you to know the end. In fact, this particular director took away the last 10 pages of the script from everyone. Wow. She didn't want anyone anticipating the ending. But anyway, that's a long way of asking your particular philosophy on that.
I didn't ask anybody to read the book. It's quite an undertaking. I was quite thrilled that Robert read it. So he was our resource. He was our cast resource. I have no problem with people you know, watching the movie or watching other versions. I think anytime you can get ideas, it's helpful. And, you know, the rehearsal process is to try things out and explore things. So I'm always open to, you know, what the actors want to try. I usually have ideas that I'd like them to try. And somewhere I like to think we land in the middle and help. The main thing here is telling the story, because there's so much and it moves so quickly. So I think you really want to always try to help your audience understand who the characters are, you know, what their relationships are and what's going on in each scene, so that you're ready to quickly move forward into the next scene. So for me, it's just keeping the relationships clear and keeping the story clear and moving. But I'm always up for people doing their own research.
The story is very important, especially in a show like this. But it's told for the most part through the songs lyrics of the songs.
And when I saw the first tour, I remember a friend said, "Now get there early and read the synopsis in the program." Mm-hmm. And I thought, "Oh, okay, whatever." Well, we did get there early, and I was so thankful I had read that synopsis, because when the show started, boy, you're just off and running, and it did help me keep things clear. And we do have a synopsis in our program for anyone who gets there a few minutes early and is not familiar. At this point, it's been around, you know, close to 30 years. A lot of people are very familiar with the story and the music. But if you're not, by all means, come and, you know, just read through, and it certainly helps as you're watching it.
The music is important, the words and the music. Now, your musical director, a lady you've worked with before, I recognized her name as having worked with
Martha
you.
Yes, Martha Risser. Mm-hmm. She's done a wonderful job. Last night was the first night we had our orchestra, and we had microphones, and it was just pretty wonderful to sit out in the audience and listen to all the orchestra and all of the singers coming together. There's just some wonderful musicians vocally and in the orchestra pit that are working on this show.
It's a nice big room there. I would think the acoustics would be great.
Yes, and I know a new sound system, new speakers are just being installed for the show, and I think the sound's going to be excellent.
Yeah, what was your biggest challenge as far as helping them to learn the numbers and interpret the numbers as much as anything else?
These two, they do very well.
Didn't really? she didn't pick on you too much?
No, I will admit, you mentioned Martha. Martha, I love working with her because she will push you to different limits than you normally would, and she keeps you honest. And I made the comment at the beginning is that no one has ever sung this the way it's written. And her big, you know, push, which I think helps down the road of when you get into character interpretation or having freedom with the music, is knowing it the way it's written. It's been a fun process. There's been some frustrating times, of course, when you sit there and you can't get a portion, you know, even though you've tried over and over and over again. But it really has been a great experience, and we have tons of talented people. I mean, our ensemble is amazing. I mean, everybody in supporting characters, our Javert is, Paul sounds absolutely fabulous. I would put this show up against any professional production ever as far as.
Okay.
It is amazing.
Yeah, well, tell us about, for instance, the costuming, I would think, would be a challenge for this.
Yes. As Robert's saying, the ensemble, there's 42 in the cast, and they all play multiple roles. So there are just stacks and stacks of costumes. Uh-huh. And I'm just praying that everyone keeps straight what they're all wearing. Because, you know, people may wear multiple things throughout the show as you're covering, you know, so many years and so many locations. But yes, the costumes, all period, they all look beautiful. We're renting some. We're getting some from the rep. We're getting them from all over. But we actually have started fitting just this week, and they look wonderful.
Yeah. Now, the show does cover a number of years. Did you ever figure out how many years that stretches over?
By the time Valjean gets out of prison till his death at the end, it's about 30 years.
Spoiler alert.
Come on.
Well, I asked the question. Yeah. It's my fault. Blame me.
No, in the first act, we jump. We start with him getting out of prison. Then we jump about 10 years. And then when we get to the second act, we're really in a span of a couple days with the student revolution before we jump to his death. So it's kind of fascinating to me how we jump, and then second act, you're kind of in just a 48-hour period before you move ahead again.
See, I don't have in my notes who did the adaptation from the book to the musical. Do you know by any chance?
I know this book is, I have to say this, Alain Boubile and Claude Michael Schoenberg.
Uh-huh.
And Claude Michael Schoenberg also did the music, and Herbert Kreitzmer did the lyrics.
Since you read the book, I'm going to ask you, do you think it's a good basic following of the book?
Actually, it really is, and it surprised me how close it was, how it really got the big chunks and the big themes. And there's obviously some changes. There's a lot of stuff that's not included. I mean, like I said, the first 125, 150 pages are just about the bishop, which in the musical is a very small part. But it made me appreciate that part so much more, reading his whole history and how really this guy was so different. I mean, to me, it just supplemented the musical so much more. I don't think you really miss anything from just seeing the musical, but I think the book really supplements it, and it made me appreciate the musical more. It's kind of like, I kind of put it akin to The Godfather.
Uh-huh.
I love that movie.
Uh-huh.
But the book is so fabulous, and once you've read the book, it supplements the movie so much better, and I think that's really what this has done for me.
In the case of The Godfather book, there's much more to the book
than
there's ever in the movie.
Absolutely, and that's what's always the case. But really, as far as the themes and the major scene work and the major catalyst type of events that happen, they're all caught there. I mean, they're all caught there. And I mean, when Victor Hugo wrote that book, there was a lot of stuff going on. It was partly a political
piece. Oh, of course. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So of what was going on and of political commentary of what he thought. I mean, there's... So a lot of that's there as well.
You see, of course he would have written the character the way he did, because he probably saw a lot of that same unfairness.
Absolutely, and I think it comes down to, I mean, you look at Javert and Valjean, and it's very much a legalistic view and a mercy type of view, and I think people have looked at that for years about the difference of, you know, even religion, for example. strict view of here's rules versus here's the other rules about mercy and being able to show compassion. And is either one better? Is either, do you need a mixture of both? What is it?
Sure, yeah, yeah. And be sure to speak into the microphone, because believe it or not, you cut out when you move to the side.
Okay, I'm usually extremely loud, that's very rare.
They're directional mics, and you have to speak right into them. So it's not your fault at all. But in the time we have left, let's talk about the songs, the ones that the public would recognize, from both of you, really. What about Julie first?
Well, I know really Fontaine's main song is probably one of the most well-known songs from the show, I Dreamed a Dream, basically, which is at the point where she's been fired from her job, doesn't really know where she's going to go, what she's going to do, and it's kind of the state of where her life is and how life has killed the dreams that she had for herself, for her daughter, for where she was hoping to be. So that, I know, is a song I love to sing. It's one that I know a lot of people know, and so that I think adds a little level of nerves for when we have an audience, because I know a lot of people will know every single word in that song and are waiting to hear how it's done. So hopefully it will go well for me when I do it, but I know that's one that definitely a lot of people are familiar with from the show.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think I've gone over a lot of the ones that I've done, but I think probably Bring Him Home is the one, at least for your musical theater repertoire, which is the most well-known that Valjean does. And I feel almost the exact same way as Julie. There's so many great singers who have sang that song. I mean, recently Alfie Beau has done it, and that guy's voice is amazing, you know, and John Owens Jones has done it, and of course Colm Wilkinson, and just some great singers have done it. So that's, I think, the most well-known. And then, of course, like Javert has Stars, which is a beautiful one.
On My Own. Eponine sings On My Own, which, again, is another famous female song from the show. So that,
Yeah, and Master of the House, it's a big ensemble number. Yeah. And there's a lot. It's I think people will be surprised of how much music they do know from it, or at least heard from, even who are.
Oh, that's a wonderful point. Just Saturday night, someone mentioned that to me. They said, I know the songs, but I don't know really what shows the songs are from. And they're often surprised when they hear that this particular song was made famous by this particular musical. They're just used to hearing it on the radio.
Absolutely.
Back then.
Absolutely.
They don't really understand the history of it. But you enjoy it so much more when you hear the history of the song and where it came from and the context. And that's probably really important in a show like this that has so much rich history to it. I mean, the story is fictional, but only to a degree, because it's probably undoubtedly based on actual things that Hugo saw. I'm talking about the book now. Actually saw and did that. So anyone wasn't what is made over from the book to the musical version, which was on stage first. What a challenge, that would have been for whoever.
And as Robert said, they did a masterful job, because when you see typical musical theater and the song will hopefully carry the story or tell you more about the character, and here it's all sung. So everything has to come through the lyrics and the songs to keep everything moving, and they really have done a wonderful job.
Yeah, the White Theater is a great building to work in.
It is.
You
can,
absolutely.
I don't know,
beautiful.
Do you fly in any scene? When I took the tour several years ago,
they
flew in the scenery.
I said it's been on my bucket list to do a show with a theater with a fly system. So, yes, we are flying in whatever we can. The set's going to be lovely. There is a fly system. It's all coming together really well, and it is a beautiful facility.
Yeah, how large is the orchestra? Some people want to know these things.
I think we have 14.
14.
A big orchestra.
Uh-huh.
They sound wonderful, so we're ready. And like I said, 42 in the cast, so it's going to be a big production.
Yeah. Just do you have a checklist of things with all the cast? Check in,
yes.
Check out.
Yes, we do.
With that many, you would have to.
Oh, yeah, everybody checking on where somebody is usually, but it's a great group of people. Everyone's worked so hard. As Robert said, Martha Risser, the vocal director and conductor, has just done a wonderful job getting the singers ready and getting the orchestra ready, and now we've got 2 weeks till we open, and it's time to put everything together.
Yeah, and it's the time is very soon now. Opening night will be Saturday, November the 9th at 7:30 p.m. Performances then continue on Sunday afternoon the 10th at 2 o'clock p.m. A few days off until Thursday the 14th at 7:30. Then we skip to Saturday the 16th at 7:30 at the Jewish Community Center. Of course, Friday is the Sabbath, so there's not a Friday show. If people will sometimes question me about that. That's the reason. So Saturday the 16th at 7:30, then a matinee on Sunday afternoon the 17th at 2, Thursday the 21st at 7:30, then Saturday the 23rd at 7:30, Sunday the 24th at 2. And you can get this, by the way, by going online to jcckc.org/boxoffice. And the number to call for the same information, if you are a calling person, is 913-327-8054. The main number of the Jewish Community Center, if you have other questions for them about other things, is 913-327-8000. The Jewish Community Center is located at 5801 West 115th Street in Overland Park, Kansas. If you map Quest, zip code 66211. It's essentially right by Sprint. I can see the parking areas for Sprint when I'm in your parking lot.
Right.
And there are exits from, is it Knoll?
It's right out. It's just west of Knoll, 115th Street.
Knoll, and there's also an entrance exit down on 119th, I believe.
Yes.
I believe I took that exit last time I came over. Yeah, so that's where it is. That's where you can find them. The shows begin November 9th, Saturday, a week from this Saturday, at the Jewish Community Center, Les Miserables. And I was taught years ago, you got to get the B sound in there to be accurate about it. I want to thank my guests for being with us. Robert Hingula, who sings the lead role in the show. Julie Call, what's the name of your character?
Fontaine.
Why can I not say that? I should write it out phonetically, of course. Thank you both for being here. And the director, Barb Nichols. First time directing at the White Theater?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we look forward to seeing you in other places and other times.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. So the Jazz Insider is next. Great jazz, great stories behind the jazz. As we said during the course of both interviews today, the songs tell a story, and they do with jazz as well. Jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you.